Planet of Exile by Ursula K. Le Guin. Copyright 1966 by Ursula K. Le Guin. Narrated by Patricia Redding LeClaire.
This book was originally created for audio cassette playback. Any announcements concerning cassettes do not apply to this recording. This version contains markers allowing direct access to major portions of the book.
Introduction to the 1978 edition. All science fiction writers are asked, with wonderful regularity, "Where do you get your ideas from?" None of us knows what to answer, except Harlan Ellison, who replies crisply, "Schenectady." The question has become a joke, even a New Yorker cartoon. And yet it is usually asked with sincerity, even with yearning. It isn't meant to be a stupid question. The trouble with it, the reason why the only possible answer to it is Schenectady, is that it isn't the right question, and there are no right answers to wrong questions, as witness the works of those who attempted to discover the properties of phlogiston. Sometimes the trouble is merely a matter of vague phrasing. What the asker really wants to know is, do you get the science in your science fiction from knowing or reading science? Answer, yes. Or, do SF writers ever steal ideas from each other? Answer, constantly. Or, do you get the action in your books from having lived all the experiences the characters live? Answer, God forbid. But sometimes the questioners can't specify. They just shift and say, well, like, you know, and then I suspect that what they're really trying to get at is a complex, difficult, and important thing. They are trying to understand the imagination, how it works, how an artist uses it or is used by it. We know so little about the imagination that we can't even ask the right questions about it, let alone give the right answers. The springs of creation remain unsounded by the wisest psychology, and an artist is often the last person to say anything comprehensible about the process of creation, though nobody else has said very much that makes sense. I guess the best place to start is in Schenectady, reading Keats. Of recent years, I, only I in this case, am always asked a second question. It is, why do you write so much about men? This is never a stupid question, nor is it a wrong question, not at all, though sometimes there is a bias in it that makes it hard to answer directly. There are women in my books and stories, and often they are the protagonists or the central viewpoint characters. And so if people ask, why do you always write about men? I reply, I don't, and I say it rather crossly, because the question so phrased is both accusatory and inaccurate. I can swallow some accusation or some inaccuracy, but the combination is poison. But again and still, however the question is phrased, what it brings up is a real and urgent concern. A flip answer is detestable. A brief answer is impossible. Planet of Exile was written in 1963 and 64, before the reawakening of feminism from its 30-year paralysis. The book exhibits my early, natural, that is, happily acculturated, unawakened, unconsciousness-raised way of handling male and female characters. At that time, I could say with a perfectly clear conscience, indeed with self-congratulation, that I simply didn't care whether my characters were male or female, so long as they were human. Why on earth should a woman have to write only about women? I was unself-conscious, without sense of obligation, therefore self-confident, unexperimental, contentedly conventional. The story starts with Rollery, but presently the point of view shifts off to Jacob and to Wold, and then back to Rollery and off again. It's an alternating viewpoints story. The men are more overtly active and far more articulate. Rollery, a young and inexperienced woman of a rigidly traditional male supremacist culture, does not fight or initiate sexual encounters or become a leader of society, or assume any other role which, in her culture or ours of 1964, would be labeled male. She is, however, a rebel, both socially and sexually. Although her behavior is not aggressive, her desire for freedom drives her to break right out of her culture mold. She changes herself entirely by allying herself with an alien self. She chooses the other. This small personal rebellion, coming at a crucial time, initiates events which lead to the complete changing and remaking of two cultures and societies. Jacob is the hero, active, articulate, rushing about, fighting bravely and governing busily. But the central mover of the events of the book, the one who chooses, is in fact Rollory. Taoism got to me earlier than modern feminism did. Where some see only a dominant hero and a passive little woman, I saw and still see the essential wastefulness and futility of aggression and the profound effectiveness of Wu Wei, action through stillness. All very well. The fact remains that in this book, as in most of my other novels, the men do most of the acting, in both senses of the word, and thus tend to occupy the center of the stage. I didn't care whether my protagonist was male or female. Well, that carefreeness is culpably careless. The men take over. Why does one let them? Well, it's ever so much easier to write about men doing things, because most books about people doing things are about men, and that is one's literary tradition. And because, as a woman, one probably has not done awfully much in the way of fighting, raping, governing, etc., but has observed that men do these things. And because, as Virginia Woolf pointed out, English prose is unsuited to the description of feminine being and doing, unless one to some extent remakes it from scratch. It is hard to break from tradition, hard to invent, hard to remake one's mother tongue. One drifts along and takes the easy way. Nothing can rouse one to go against the stream, to choose the hard way, but a profoundly stirred and probably an angry conscience. But the conscience must be angry. If it tries to reason itself into anger, it produces only guilt, which chokes the springs of creation at their source. I am often very angry as a woman, but my feminist anger is only an element in, a part of, the rage and fear that possess me when I face what we are all doing to each other, to the earth, and to the hope of liberty and life. I still don't care whether people are male or female, when they are all of us and all our children. One soul unjustly imprisoned, am I to ask which sex it is? A child starving, am I to ask which sex it is? The answer of some radical feminists is yes. Granted the premise that the root of all injustice, exploitation, and blind aggression is sexual injustice, this position is sound. I cannot accept the premise. Therefore, I cannot act upon it. If I forced myself to, and my form of action is writing, I would write dishonestly and badly. Am I to sacrifice the ideal of truth and beauty in order to make an ideological point? Again, the radical feminist's answer may be yes. Though that answer is sometimes identical with the voice of the censor, speaking merely for fanatic or authoritarian bigotry, it may not be. It may speak in the service of the ideal itself. To build, one must tear down the old. The generation that has to do the tearing down has all the pain of destruction and little of the joy of creation. The courage that accepts that task and all the ingratitude and obloquy that go with it is beyond praise. But it can't be forced or faked. If it is forced, it leads to mere spitefulness and self-destructiveness. If it is faked, it leads to feminist chic, the successor to radical chic. It's one thing to sacrifice fulfillment in the service of an ideal. It's another to suppress clear thinking and honest feeling in the service of an ideology. An ideology is valuable only insofar as it is used to intensify clarity and honesty of thought and feeling. Feminist ideology has been immensely valuable to me in this respect. It has forced me and every thinking woman of this generation to know ourselves better, to separate, often very painfully, what we really think and believe from all the easy truths and facts we were subliminally taught about being male, being female, sex roles, female physiology and psychology, sexual responsibility, etc., etc. All too often we have found that we had no opinion or belief of our own, but had simply incorporated the dogmas of our society. And so we must discover, invent, make our own truths, our values, ourselves. This remaking of the woman self is a release and relief to those who want and need group support, or whose womanhood has been systematically reviled, degraded, exploited in childhood, marriage, and work. To others, like myself, to whom the peer group is no home, and who have not been alienated from their own being as woman, this job of self-examination and self-birth does not come easy. I like women. I like myself. Why mess it all up? I don't care if they're men or women. Why on earth should a woman have to write about only women? All the questions are valid. None has an easy answer. But they must now be asked and answered. A political activist can take her answers from the current ideology of her movement, but an artist has got to dig those answers out of herself and keep on digging until she knows she has got as close as she possibly can get to the truth. I keep digging. I use the tools of feminism and try to figure out what makes me work and how I work, so that I will no longer work in ignorance or irresponsibly. It is not a brief or easy business. One is groping down in the dark of the mind and body, a long, long way from Schenectady. How little we really know about ourselves, woman or man. One thing I seem to have dug up is this. The person I tend to write about is often not exactly, or not totally, either a man or a woman. On the superficial level, this means there is little sexual stereotyping. The men aren't lustful and the women aren't gorgeous, and the sex itself is seen as a relationship rather than an act. Sex serves mainly to define gender, and the gender of the person is not exhausted, or even very nearly approached, by the label man or woman. Indeed, both sex and gender seem to be used mainly to define the meaning of person or of self. Once, as I began to be awakened, I closed the relationship into one person, an androgyne. But more often it appears conventionally and overtly as a couple, both in one, or two making a whole. Yin does not occur without yang, nor yang without yin. Once I was asked what I thought the central constant theme of my work was, and I said spontaneously, marriage. I haven't yet written a book worthy of that tremendous and staggeringly unfashionable theme. I haven't even figured out yet what I meant. But rereading this early, easygoing adventure story, I think the theme is there. Not clear, not strong, but being striven towards. I learn by going where I have to go. Ursula K. Le Guin, May 1977.